Okay, I just got in saying about Pfizer's course on steroids. I think the text that came out of that was chemistry of compounds related to phenanthrene. That sounds familiar. I think that was
chemistry of active compounds related to phenanthrene. And Pfizer gave the lectures, gave in lectures what later became that book. And that was a very useful course in learning something about that area of natural products, which incidentally was the dominant area of natural products of that time. And the work of Wieland and Windaus, and the early X-ray crystallography that was done on that system that led to the solution of the structural problem in steroids was quite important chemistry. Parenthetically, I have maintained for years that that was a trap into which organic chemistry fell.
Mm-hmm.
That when Emil Fischer dominated organic chemistry, the subjects of organic chemistry were the sugars, the amino acids and proteins, and the purines and pyrimidines, though not the nucleic acids, but the purines and pyrimidines from the nucleic acids. And those were the topics that Fischer brought into organic chemistry and constituted the core of organic chemistry in his day. And of course he worked with enzymes and the stereochemical demonstrations within the field of carbohydrates was often done in Fischer's laboratory in Zeiningen. When organic chemists became enamored of the steroids, the pendulum swung in that direction so far, in my view, that they gave up studying and continuing with the things that Fischer had been doing, and left to a relatively small core of individuals, plus a new class of chemists called biochemists, the investigation of an area of organic chemistry which I regard as perhaps the most interesting. I don't think that this, or my claim is, that bringing organic chemists into biochemistry, which if I have any proud boast I claim to have a part in doing, is only bringing them back to their patrimony. It's coming back to Emil Fischer. And my claim for many years is that what's good enough for Emil Fischer is good enough for me. So I was fascinated by this steroid business, and it was a marvelous course that Fischer gave. But I wish that organic chemists hadn't gone overboard. Sorry. I wish the organic chemists had not gone what I regard as overboard in that direction, and had maintained to a greater extent the subjects that have been the life's work of the individual who most of us would regard as the greatest of organic chemists. Well, anyway, to get back to the courses. The following year I had Bartlett's course in physical organic chemistry. First time he gave it. He came here as an instructor, a so-called faculty instructor, which meant a a tenure
bearing line,
in instructor, faculty instructor, and he gave his course in physical organic chemistry, and I took that. I went over to physics to try to take a course in electricity and magnetism, but I got over my course that was over my head. I didn't take an elementary enough course, couldn't manage it, and quit, which is too bad. And I didn't take a course in electricity and magnetism until I was on the staff of the University of Chicago, when I went over to the physics department and took the course in electricity and magnetism that I should have had all along. I don't think I had any other courses here at Harvard except the ones I've recited.
Oh.
There weren't many given in the department at the time.
Do you remember any course that was called physical organic chemistry?
Before Paul's? Paul gave a half year of physical...
Okay. Did Conant give it before?
Oh.
It may have been...
Conant may have given such a course before him. I think he did. But I was not...
That's right.
Ready for it.
Right. Okay.
And never had it. Yes, I think Conant may have done that before him. And of course, it was Conant whose enthusiasm for Hammett's work led me to read Hammett's work. Whereupon I became very enthusiastic. I can tell you about the very papers I've read about it that really excited me.
Okay, do you want to quit for now?
We can go on.
Okay.
It doesn't matter.
Fine.
We can go on until the end of the tape and then go to lunch.
Good enough.
But it was Conant who got me to read Hammett.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the Hammett and Derrick papers, which seems so ridiculously simple today, were very difficult papers for me to handle.
Mm-hmm.
And Hammett had a paper on acidity in general that was, that was the limit of my capacity, but I loved it. And the Hammett and Flexner paper I thought was fabulous. So I was a wild Hammett enthusiast then, an opinion that I had no reason to change at any time. And enjoyed that. I don't know where I got on to Lapworth's papers. I don't know who told me to read those. Maybe Conant. All my life I've regarded Lapworth as the great physical organic chemist.
Mm-hmm.
The individual who broke most sharply with tradition, who everybody stands on everyone else's shoulders. I mean, there is no such thing as total originality. But if I were looking for originality in the field of physical organic chemistry, I go back to Lapworth. I think his 1898 paper on cyanohydrin formation is wonderful. And his 1903 or maybe it's 1904 paper, I guess 1904 paper, on the halogenation of acetone seems to me, as it did when I read it as a student, seems to me still the greatest paper in physical organic chemistry that has ever been written. And I would like to present that argument if you're willing to listen to this. At that time, Lapworth used reaction kinetics to delineate mechanism. And the reaction kinetics were unusual because a reaction that apparently involved bromine was zero order in bromine. And it led to a clear statement of mechanism. Furthermore, that paper contains in it a single sentence that is, I'm almost quoting, we could get the exact quote, but reads something like this. The rate of bromination of acetone is the same in diffuse daylight as in complete darkness as in diffuse daylight, and is unaffected by the presence or absence of neutral salts. That sentence is really food for thought for 1904. Yes. But in 1913, Bodenstein published his famous paper on the reaction between hydrogen and iodine, worked out the reaction kinetics, determined the activation energy, and proposed a mechanism for the reaction, which was a simple biomolecular reaction. My physical chemical friends, especially Professor Kistiakowsky, regard that as the origin, the first proper paper in reaction kinetics, the first paper of any significance. It was 9 years post Lapworth it was dull by comparison because the reaction seemed to be a simple biomolecular reaction, where Lapworth was a very interesting and intricate one. And Bodenstein, incidentally, had the bad luck to be wrong. That is, the mechanism he formulated turned out to be incorrect, and the reaction is, in fact, a chain reaction where the rapid equilibration that controls the concentration of the iodine atoms is such that you get a transition state which is IH2I, coming apart to 2HI, instead of the instead of this.
Yes.
Well, of course, he was unlucky. He was terribly unlucky. But it is kind of interesting that 9 years before Bodenstein, Lapworth had applied reaction kinetics to mechanism in a highly significant way and gotten it right, and had a paper in which he so took for granted that he made no fuss about the fact that you worry in reaction kinetics in solution about photochemical reactions and about salt effects. Those papers really made a tremendous impression.
I think it was probably also as almost as impressive as the fact that, he was using bonding in a way that no one else was to use for another 25 years.
My statement about Lapworth is he got so far, he was a leader who got so far ahead of his followers that they couldn't see him.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he's been grossly underhonored in the world. And, well, there's a story about that that maybe Gene will tell you at dinner, because it's kind of...
The Robinson... that did
it. Yes. Well, the Robinson 1917 paper on the tropinone alkaloids. The other great paper that I thought was just too marvelous, mm-hmm. and this is the kind of thing I would like to have imitated. Mechanistic approach to organic chemistry, to organic synthesis. So those were the big papers. Then I was reading Engel, and I know I was reading Engel at the time, though exactly what papers I read, when and where, I don't know. What I remember most clearly, and this puts it a couple years later than graduate work, was my second year, I think, at the University of Chicago when Bill Whelan came on the staff.
Could I suggest that maybe...
I don't skip that far ahead.
Yeah, no, I just want to ask you something back. That maybe your interest in Lapworth was instigated by hearing Kohler talk about him in his lectures. Because Paul Bartlett mentioned that.
Might very well be.
Okay.
Is also possible that Conant talked about it. For all I would know, Kohler mentioned the Robinson work. I don't remember. In my not remembering when I ran Ingold, that's why I was saying about when I know.
Yes.
I know I was well acquainted with Ingold's papers by the time Whelan arrived at the University of Chicago, which was about 1937, I think, or maybe 1938. We could look that up in American Neuroscience. But when he arrived and we met,
I knew it. Pauling all this time?
He had been with Paul. He had also been with Ingold for a brief period. I don't know. Maybe just a month or two, but he had been with Pauling all this time, and I knew his work, of course, mm-hmm. and had great admiration for it. But he didn't know. I hadn't done anything at that time that he should have known about, and. When he arrived at the University of Chicago, we met in the library of the chemistry department, and he quizzed me very, very thoroughly on Ingold's papers. In fact, I knew Ingold's papers. The reaction kinetics business was something I thoroughly understood. And I passed my tests. If I hadn't passed my tests, he and I never would have been friends.
Okay. But you were prepared.
But I don't know. That was the fundamentals of physical organic chemistry at the time. But I don't know when I read them. I don't know how early I had read them. Other things. And some of them related to biochemistry. Stanley crystallized the tobacco mosaic virus in 1935. I went back and looked it up. When I met Gene for the first time, which was just after I got my PhD in 1934. What I told her about was Stanley's tobacco mosaic virus. Now that may not seem exactly what you would...
buried you anyway?
She not only buried me anyway, but it is her claim that she married me because of that. That the young man that she had been going out with
frivolous.
Were more frivolous. Yes. Did not have, some driving interest to their life.
And if she didn't understand much about the tobacco mosaic virus, she understood that I was very enthusiastic. And it's clear that somehow or other, I knew about the tobacco mosaic virus roughly as soon as Stanley published it. I have searched my mind to know how I knew it, because I am not as great a literature reader as many of our friends. Mm-hmm. And I doubt that I picked that up on my own. Maybe I did. Mm-hmm. If you want to guess, my guess is that Al Sapkowski mentioned it to me, and then I went and read it. Or somebody mentioned it to me, and then I went and read it. And Corwin seems a likely person. I don't know. But I was full of it at the time. I don't know exactly when my fundamental interest in biochemistry arose. And you asked about this. And I can say something about it, but
it's not the exact date. Yeah. So
I don't know how to date it. I had remembered when I read your letter just what it was. I knew perfectly. It was when I read Baldwin's Dynamic Aspects of Biochemistry. Well, it turns out
that's the one where
it turns out that the first edition was 1947, and that's just nonsense.
You know what's interesting? Well, you may have already started the work, but your papers just started to come out about then.
No, but I will go back, and you'll find that I've been doing that. One of the best pieces of biochemistry I did never got published for its fancy. It was much earlier.
I see.
Much earlier. But when I was at Columbia, and I want to talk about Columbia because that was a wonderful group of people that had enormous influence on me. Splendid group.
Just 1 minute.
Okay. When I was at Columbia, there was a seminar program similar to the Bartlett Friday afternoon physical organic seminars, where students and postdoctoral spoke. And I gave a seminar then on the pathway of alcoholic fermentation. So this was 1935 or 6. Mm-hmm. And while I was the important papers, which were Meyerhoff papers, had only come out that year or the year before. I didn't go back to check, but I'm pretty sure that Meyerhoff's papers on the mechanism of alcoholic fermentation, in particular, Meyerhoff was the person who discovered the retroaldol condensation of fructose 1,6-diphosphate. And that was recent work, and of course that's the key really to alcoholic fermentation and to glycolysis in muscle. And I gave my seminar at Columbia on that work, going back to the beginning of it as best I could, and giving Meyerhoff's discovery, which was recent. Now, I once owned, I no longer own, but I once owned Hardin's book on alcoholic fermentation. Where the second edition came out in 1932. Now, whether I bought that when I was still at Harvard, or whether I bought that when I was at Columbia, or perhaps even later, I don't know. I think I must have had it when I was at Columbia and prepared that seminar. Of course, Hardin's book could not have in it the Retroaldo, because it hadn't been discovered. But it did have in it the phosphorylation of glucose and the various phosphate esters, the Hardin-Young ester, the Neuberg ester, and so on, that had been isolated and that looked like they were going to be intermediates in the metabolic pathway of glycolysis and fermentation. So, my interest in biochemical pathways, if not mechanisms, I think mechanisms, because really it was the mechanistic aspect of Meyerhoff's work that that would catch me and did catch me. So I think that the fact I gave that seminar is fairly good evidence that I had those interests at the time. While I was at Columbia, I had bought two textbooks of biochemistry and remember the name of one of them and not the other. One of them was Bodansky's book. I don't know what the other one was. And I read them. I have not gone back to them since you've written me, but my recollection is that they were dreadful books in that they were organized sort of as what chemical compounds do you find in what body fluids? You know, what can you get out of urine? What can you get out of blood? What do you find in muscle? And so on. And you list them. And the chemical notion that you have to transform one material into another somehow in my recollection, at least, it might be nice to go back to the book and see if I'm right, was a minor part of either Bodansky or the other book I have. Mm-hmm. Whereas Hardin's alcoholic fermentation, although it couldn't go very far, was concerned with how do you get from here to there, which is the problem of chemistry, or well, that's true. Chemistry has the problem of structure and has the problem of transformations. But on the transformations problem, that's where it was. So, by the time I was at Columbia, I was off on a program of self-study in biochemistry, and gave a seminar which my guess is was at the time absolutely up to date on fermentation, glycolysis.
It's interesting that when you taught your course, which I took many years later in the late 1950s, I guess, mm-hmm. in biochemistry, and you were still... That's how you taught the course. How do you go from one place to another? And I remember, I think, dealing with the Krebs cycle, and everyone was having so much trouble, and I thought, not that I could repeat it to you now, but it seemed perfectly obvious, because you were teaching us how to go from one step to the next. And obviously you set out a certain plan at that time, which you maintained for a long time to come. It sort of fits things together now in my own mind. You've dealt with I assume that was by design that you were doing it in 1959 or 1958.
Yes, sure.
That it wasn't accidental.
But I hadn't. I would not have thought of this really as just growing out of what I had done before. But I guess. Everything grows out of what it does before. The structures of DPN and TPN were determined in 1935. I don't think I knew about it at the time. I went back to see when they were discovered. I don't think I knew that. I think when I was given the sequence, there was an oxidation reduction coenzyme, and one knew that there was an oxidation reduction coenzyme, but I don't think the structures... they had just been published, but I don't think I knew them. Of course, what one knew in 1935 is very... 1936 is very hard to say. I went back to look up the story on the crystallization of enzymes. I'm pretty sure that I knew when I was at Columbia that enzymes were proteins. And that probably was even in a textbook like Bedansky's. The crystallization of urease by Sumner, I have written down the date someplace, was 1926. And I imagine that by 1935 the textbooks had incorporated that pretty well. There was a lot of contention about it at the time, in 26. I don't know if you know that story. That's a very interesting aspect of history of chemistry. We can talk about it at lunch because it's relevant. Then Northrop at Rockefeller had been...